The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So will there or won't there be a deal? Late last night there were whispers that actually a deal may be a bit further away than people thought. Katie, what did we hear last night?
So I think there was a growing sense, though I think some people remain sceptical as if I had to cover Brexit for the past, you know, three years or so. But there was a growing sense that we were edging towards a Brexit deal. You had some quite optimistic reports in the press. I think the Daily Mail reported that we could have had a deal as soon as yesterday. And I think there was hope that there was movement on fishing. And you obviously had the overnight talks. But then last night you began to hear from the UK side that in the afternoon, talks had taken a turn for the worse, and that this was because, in their view, the goalposts had been moved by the other side. So, not on fish, but talking about things like level playing field, the EU and the UK side started to change what it was talking about, adding in things. This, I think, has not been fully confirmed by the EU side, but I think there is a sense that at the last minute, people were trying to do grabs, you know, get more from it. And this was causing problems in terms of the talks. I think there's also talk that perhaps part of the reason they're pushing more for things in other places is because the deal on fisheries is not as good as the EU wanted. So if they're going to go along with that, they want more elsewhere. So I think that's the point we're at. I think you're looking at the countries which are, you know, the member states which are the most opposed. We go back to France, which we always knew Emmanuel Macron, even though he does appear to have a good relationship in terms of getting on with Boris Johnson, is perhaps the most difficult leader for the UK when it comes to getting a Brexit deal, because he ultimately sees Brexit as something which is not in France's interests, and particularly on fisheries and other things is pushing quite hard. So now there are various reports, you know, saying France threatens to veto bad Brexit deal, talks on the brink of collapse. I think that if you scratch the surface a bit, I don't think it is seen as a given that we are heading towards a deal. I still think that there is a sense on the UK side that, you know, that is the direction it's going in. It's just that there are going to be a few stumbling blocks on the way, and probably it was a bit premature to think things would be wrapped up so quickly. I think in terms of real deadlines, as we were talking on the podcast yesterday, it's more the beginning of the week that we're coming to. So Monday, you have this EU summit on the 10th on Thursday, and you also have the votes on the internal market bill, the various ways the UK might want to break international law, which are going to rile the EU. So next week is where things will truly come to a head, and we're not just saying that. So I think there's still the weekend for issues to get resolved. I still think on the UK side, you know, people will be surprised if there is not a deal, but it clearly isn't a given.
James, you write in your Times column today that the deadline, as Katie says, is the end of the weekend, Monday. So do you think that what we heard last night was just last minute negotiating tactics, or is there actually a gulf to still cross?
No, I think what's going on is in both camps, the people who want a deal on their terms are ramping up the pressure. So you had Clement Beaune, France's Europe Minister, today suggesting that France could veto the deal when it's brought to the European Council if it doesn't like it. That is designed to put pressure on Michel Barnier and Ursula von der Leyen, because they have a more difficult job than Boris Johnson and David Frost right now, because they have to take a judgment call on what the 27 EU member states will accept as a deal. If they went back with and said, look, in advance, here's the compromise, what do you think? That would get unravelled, because people would object to this bit or that bit, and then it wouldn't be a compromise anymore with the UK. So they have a more difficult job. And I think how vocal the French have been about their willingness to veto and the like is an attempt to basically remind Barnier and von der Leyen not to do, as one European diplomat put it to me, a Theresa May, you know, sign off on a deal that ultimately their own side can't accept. Then on the UK side, you've got people close to the ERG basically saying, you know, they've been very quiet in recent months, but essentially saying, we are ready to revive ourselves, spring back up, if we feel that this deal, if Boris Johnson signs a deal which we feel falls short of the standards that we expect. So I think you are seeing people on both sides trying to put pressure on the other. That has meant both sides are more wary about moving. And that means that bridging the distance that remains between the two sides becomes even more difficult. Now, I think that, you know, the big question, I think, is this, is one would expect Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen to speak at some point. You know, regardless of whether there's going to be a deal or not be a deal, it would be very odd if they didn't speak. The big question, I think, now becomes, can that conversation move things forward? Can that conversation unblock stuff? Can the two negotiators get close enough that Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen can kind of shove something through, find a way through? I mean, that is the big question. I still think that there is a moment at some... There is also this other point, which is the big thing that I think everyone needs to realise is that no deal is not the continuation of the negotiations by other means, but it would spiral out of control very quickly. And so don't imagine that no deal will be a 3-month long affair. It's going to be longer than that because there will be so much bad blood, but it will take a long time, I think, before you could restart the talks with any hope of success.
Mm. And meanwhile, the business secretary, Alok Sharma, has had the broadcast round this morning to announce the UK's new target for cutting UK's carbon emissions. But he ended up having to answer some questions on vaccines, and he sounded like he was rowing back, Katie, on how many vaccines we'd actually be getting.
Yes, so the issue here is it's not the overall amount, but in terms of the time in which we expect to get the doses, there's been a slight issue with Pfizer, which is Pfizer is halving its delivery. So the UK government says they will still have millions of doses this year, but it is not going to be the full volume they first anticipated. This is because Pfizer, if you look at that vaccine, as we've discussed in this podcast previously, it has to be kept at a cold temperature, which is colder than the North Pole. And I think there's also some complications when it comes to splitting it into smaller batches, and therefore it just is taking a little bit longer to get them over here. Now, I don't think that has a huge impact in terms of the big picture stuff, because they're still eventually getting here. But it does have an impact in the sense of, for example, if you look at that prioritisation list of who gets the vaccine first, there are questions at the rate we're getting at as to, you know, when NHS workers will get it, because it on the order, I think care homes are the priority, and therefore it does just slow things a bit. So I still think it's a very positive news from the government's perspective on vaccines, but I think it's just a reminder, and probably why Boris Johnson is trying to sound not too optimistic at all these press conferences when he's talking about vaccines, that it's still a pretty long road, and we don't really have a roadmap yet in terms of when XX people are going to be vaccinated, what it means other people can do, or anything like that. And I think that this is just another sign that just because we're going to start seeing, you know, needles going into arms doesn't mean it's all over.
I thought we also saw another sign with that. But two things, I think. First, I would just to take on the point Katie made. The announcement today that even if you've been vaccinated, you would still have to self-isolate for 14 days if you've been in close contact with someone who tested positive for the virus is a reminder that until kind of everyone has been vaccinated, you're not going to see that much easing of restrictions. I mean, the second point about the Pfizer news is it increases. I know I bang on about this with such endless ferocity that I suspect the readers are going to throw something, listeners even, are going to throw something at their, whatever they listen to their podcast on when I say this. But it increases the importance of whether or not the Oxford vaccine is approved by the regulator. Because the Oxford vaccine solves two of the problems that are presented today. First of all, it isn't anywhere near as complex in terms of supply chain distribution as the Pfizer one, because it can be kept at kind of just simple fridge temperature. The second one is that the UK has got enough doses on that on order to vaccinate the entire population. And so you get round this whole question of prioritisation. Basically, as the vaccine's going to roll, you know that you're going to give everyone the jab. So yes, you have an order in which it's done, but it is not as complex or as fraught as it is doing it with the Pfizer vaccine, where you only have a limited number of doses and you can't be sure because it's not it's not being manufactured in your own country, you can't be sure of the precise timings of when you're going to get each batch.
Mm. And on vaccines, one of the key challenges the government also faces is vaccine scepticism, you know, the fears over the speed with which this vaccine has been developed and also approved. Someone that didn't help with these worries is the US infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci after he made these comments.
They really rushed through that approval. The FDA, the United States of America Food and Drug Administration, is the gold standard of regulation. They're doing it in a very careful way, appropriately.
Fauci has later apologised, saying that he didn't mean what it sounded like. He didn't mean that the UK was sloppy. But Katie, do you think that the government is mindful or worried about vaccine scepticism, that people won't want to, the whole population won't want to be injected?
Yeah, I think they're worried about vaccine scepticism in the sense of anti-vaxxers. And I think everyone in their head probably has a stereotype of an anti-vaxxer. But as a country, we are doing better than some countries in terms of we are more pro-vaccine, for example, than France, if you look at polling, as a nation. So I think that is encouraging to the UK government when it comes to rolling out this vaccine. However, there is scepticism, and I don't think it is. And I think the sense is not just this stereotype of people on chat rooms, you know, pushing on about this stuff. There are lots of people the government wants to reach out to, particularly in some minority groups, where they think that people are worried about coming forward. And they have that. I think if you look at some of the trials they've had in terms of vaccines, there are some groups that they think are more cautious and more concerned. So it's ways of reaching out. One thing we've heard about, for example, is getting public figures, celebrities to talk about the vaccine. I think that's something that's being looked at. And I think that you also, you know, well, I mean, a Tory MP a while ago suggested it, but we've since had, you know, Piers Morgan suggesting Matt Hancock gets injected live on TV. I think while people laugh about all this idea of, you know, politicians getting it first and things, there does seem to be something, a pattern in terms of polling, that I think seeing the Prime Minister get vaccinated on television could actually be quite good for encouraging others to do it. I don't think, although it's seen as a bit of a joke, I think that if you look at polling, that there are a significant number of people who say they would feel more confident, that they're fairly confident, they feel more confident if they saw, you know, that happen. I don't think we're quite going to get vaccines in the Commons chamber, but you can see perhaps a way for a bit of a stunt there with you know, the Prime Minister or other cabinet ministers. I think, though, in terms of, I suppose, wider scepticism, I think that if you look at things like the Fauci comments, also some of the feedback from the EU when the UK approved Pfizer first, I think that's obviously seen as very unhelpful. I think that Gavin Williamson's obviously got a lot of flack today for suggesting that the UK was, you know, the best. I think his comments were a bit tongue-in-cheek, but I think one of the issues the UK government has is it wants to say, look, we're great, we've greenlit this vaccine before anyone else. But I think by saying they've done it before anyone else, they must need to explain why they've done it before anyone else and how it's very secure. I think almost the focusing on the speed by which the UK has done it isn't necessarily so helpful to the public health message, not because any steps were skipped, but I just think it's one of those things where it's just not the main thing here. The main thing is there is a vaccine that's been approved. There's a vaccine that's been tested out. It's gone through all the procedures. And I think talking about the speed maybe is a little bit of a distraction or an error.
I just think, I think on the speed point, I mean, it's worth noting two things. One, and there are two reasons why the UK has been able to do it quicker. The first is the UK basically did a lot of this kind of rolling work, watching the trials in progress to a greater extent than some other regulators have done. And then the second is the point made by Chris Smythe, the Whitehall correspondent of The Times, that because of this, the odd nature of this Brexit transition period, basically the only thing the UK's medical regulator was working on was the vaccine. It's still relying on the European Medicines Agency for all other medicines. And so it actually had more spare capacity to look at the vaccine than any other regulator, which is one of the other reasons why it has managed to do it faster. I personally think that Anthony Fauci, and I think you can tell this from the way he tried to walk his comments back, was slightly indulging in beggar my neighbour politics, which is essentially, as Juliette Samuel, the Telegraph columnist, pointed out, governments all over the the Western world, all over the world indeed, will need people to have confidence to take the vaccine. If you start critiquing other countries' regulatory decisions to approve the vaccine, you are not going to help with public confidence on this. So I do think it was perhaps a slightly short-sighted comment by him.
And on the politicians taking the vaccine, it'll be interesting to see stateside, where the former presidents Obama, Bush and Clinton have pledged to take the vaccine live on television, how that goes down. Katie and James, thanks very much.